The Tom Woods Show, episode 2320.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, believing that the end of the world might be a bad thing that we should try to avoid is not a Russian talking point. But if we are going to avoid World War III, it's important for Americans to understand what's been left out of the CIA's narrative about Russia and Ukraine. Coming to the rescue here is my brand new free ebook, Your Facebook Friends Are Wrong About Ukraine. Pick it up at wrongaboutukraine.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. I'm delighted to be joined today by Wanjiru Njoya, who is a senior lecturer at the law school at the University of Exeter. She has taught at numerous places across the UK and is the author most recently of Redressing Historical Injustice, Self-Ownership, Property Rights, and Economic Equality with our friend and Tom Woods Show guest, David Gorton. So, Wanjiru, welcome to the show.
Hi, Tom. Thanks so much for inviting me. Glad to be here.
I just saw your lecture at the Mises Institute's Austrian Economics Research Conference. Were you delivering the Rothbard lecture?
It was, yes. It was the Murray Rothbard Memorial Lecture, yes.
Okay. I guess I want to know, every once in a while with a guest, before I dig into the material, I want to know a little bit about their personal story. And I don't want to say conversion, because this is not a religion. But I think you know what I mean. Most of us do not come into the world with these ideas fully formed. And as you well know, there is quite a bit of, let's say, social and cultural prejudice against the kinds of ideas that you advance in your books and in your work. So how did you come to adopt them?
So my conversion, you're so right. Many of us don't start out writing about these types of ideas. So what I would call my conversion was just when this whole movement started, the one that they call anti-racism, and they sort of started trying to get everybody to follow along with these ideas. And I started thinking, I wasn't doing anything to do with that. My research and teaching was in corporate governance, so nothing to do with all this. But then I started thinking, well, hang on, that's not right. So I started writing about it just because I think many of us have been forced to start talking about it as a way of fighting back against it.
And where did you grow up? Did you grow up in the UK?
Well, I grew up in Kenya, did my first law degree at the University of Nairobi, and came to England for graduate studies.
And then you just stayed?
And then I just stayed. I'm still here. Yes.
Ah, okay. Well, I guess I've been there only a couple of times and I haven't seen as much of it as I'd like. I'm coming back in July to London.
And right.
As a tourist, I can say I've absolutely thoroughly enjoyed my time there. I'm sure things would grate on me if I stayed, just as with any place. But
yes.
I've really missed being there. Last time I went was February 2020. So it was just on the eve of course, everything happening and going wrong. And I remember wondering if I'd ever get back because of all the mandates and stuff. I wondered if I'd ever have a chance to visit again. And now it's like the world has been made anew in a way.
Yes, it's nice to see all these places again. I spent 2 years at LSE, so I know London a little bit. And a few years, 6 years in Oxford, many, many years in Cambridge, a couple of years in Canterbury, University of Kent. So I've been around the country. I think it's lovely if you can get out of London.
So did you encounter Rothbard's ideas when you were still living in Kenya?
No, I encountered Rothbard's ideas when I started writing my book on equality law. So I don't know if you know, but the academy, we don't tend, at least not until recently, to look at sort of ideas outside what is called received wisdom, I suppose. So no, I never encountered Rothbard until I started writing about equality legislation. And at the time, I was writing about Hayek, the way he says social justice is an empty concept and that sort of thing. Oh, and also I was following Richard Epstein's 1992 book, Forbidden Grounds.
On anti-discrimination law.
That's right. So that's the sort of thing that I was reading at the time when I accidentally stumbled upon Rothbard's Egalitarianism as a Revolt Against Nature.
That is such a provocative title, is it not? Both as a book and an essay.
It is, and it's absolutely brilliant because at the time I was looking at it from a utilitarian perspective and saying, how is this going to work anyway? It's not going to work. It's hopeless. And this was really, I mean, I had this idea already that there's something quite evil about egalitarianism, but hadn't seen it articulated until I read that essay, Rothbard's essay. So I stumbled upon Rothbard quite by chance.
Egalitarianism can mean a variety of things to different people. And so if somebody claims to be an egalitarian, well, I'm not so sure about the person to start with, but at the same time, I don't know exactly what's meant by that. Very few egalitarians actually mean a literal equal distribution of resources. But every now and then I'm sure you do run into somebody like that, or somebody like John Rawls, I know you've written about.
Yes.
Rawls would say that we can allow there to be some material differences, let's say, in compensation among different occupations, as long as the existence of that difference benefits the poor. So it's good for physicians to be paid a premium, because if they weren't, people wouldn't become physicians and then the poor wouldn't have health care. So he can allow it on those particular grounds. But I wonder, does that mean, if I may ask parenthetically, does that mean that in principle, if he could get everything he wants, like enough doctors and everything else, with a purely equal distribution of resources, then would there be no reason to oppose that?
In fact, unlike many people, well, first of all, I'm not a philosopher. So unlike many people, I have no problem with Rawls or anybody else who has ideas about how they want society to be ordered until they start trying to force people along. That, to me, is the problem. It's not Rawls and his ideas or anything, but the fact that we're all now being told this is what we have to do, which is backed by force. That's what's wrong. So when I first started reading Rawls, it wasn't out of any interest in Rawls whatsoever. I was doing corporate law, property law, nothing to do with legal philosophy. But when I first got onto Rawls, that was because the academic gatekeepers said, you have to read Rawls. Everybody must read Rawls, because if you don't, it means you're not doing it properly, which I resented. So you just have to wonder, if his idea is so good, why do people have to be forced into it? That's the question that I have. In fact, that's my opposition to the egalitarian schemes, is the fact that they are mandatory. They're not simply a suggestion for what people ought to do. So I don't know about your question about physicians, if we had enough. I mean, I don't even know how that would work. I think any proposal is fine. It can be put on the table as long as people aren't being forced into it.
Well, how would you define egalitarian so that it includes as many possible supporters of the idea?
To me, I include everyone who thinks that equality is a goal that we should be pursuing. So I think what you're getting at there is that different egalitarians have different ideas about the extent to which we should be pursuing equality. So some people say you only need a minimum amount of equality, and other people say, no, you need total equality, and other people are sort of within that range, and they may disagree amongst themselves on how much equality is enough equality. But I would include them all within the same frame of people to whom I'm opposed when they say we ought to be pursuing equality as a goal, because I think it's inherently totalitarian. I think even if people say we only want a minimum amount of equality, even for that, what they have to do to achieve it becomes tyrannical. That's what's wrong with it.
I don't suppose you saw this clip because it's an American politician and you are happily insulated from those, I hope. But there was not that long ago an exchange between television host Bill Maher and our perennial presidential candidate Bernie Sanders, who was asked whether his program fell more under the designation of equality or equity. And he needed clarification on this. So Bill Maher explained it and said, well, I understand equality as being the pursuit of a society in which everybody has an equal chance, whereas equity involves the results you get and making sure that the results are equal. So which side do you come down on? Well, he obviously comes down on the side of equity, but he's so confused. He said, oh, equality. Now, that is not his program, but he doesn't even know his own program. He doesn't even understand which side of this divide he's on. So he's a thoroughly confused egalitarian.
Well, I did see the clip, and he's confused for a reason, which is, in fact, there is no divide between equality of opportunity and equality of outcome. They would like to make us think there's a divide so that people can say, oh, we support equality of opportunity, but we don't support equality of outcome. In fact, I would say the vast majority of people, if you ask them, that's what they would say. They would say, we support equality of opportunity, but we don't support equality of outcome. But in fact, that's a false divide, because the way they achieve their so-called equality of opportunity is by testing and measuring gaps and testing and measuring outcomes. So they would like to make you think there's a difference, but there isn't. So even if you say we just want equal chances for everyone, which is equality of opportunity, some people say equalize the starting line, but don't equalize the result. But even if you say it that way, how would you in life ensure that everybody has an equal starting line? People don't have equal starting lines. We all start where we are. So if you come from a dysfunctional family, you don't have an equal chance at life than somebody else who comes from a stable family. So even if you say, well, we're just equalizing the starting points, even that is going to be incredibly oppressive. So the reason why people struggle to distinguish the two things is that it's a false dichotomy. And in fact, isn't that what they said when they started passing all these laws like the Civil Rights Act and what we've got here, the Equality Act? They said, it's just going to be equality of opportunity. So that's what they're enforcing at the moment. And if you see how it works, there's no difference between that and equality of outcome.
I have corrected at least one or two guests on the show who have come on and said, I favor equality of opportunity. Because the issue becomes, what do you mean by that?
Yes.
When Andrew Jackson's supporters in the 1830s used the expression equal rights, they didn't mean by equal rights that the federal government would subsidize some people or give some people a leg up so they would be on an equal footing. By equal rights, they meant there will be no state-imposed obstacles placed in the way of anybody. That's what they meant by equal. We equally get nothing from the government.
Exactly. Exactly. That is it. Exactly. Yeah.
And so in that sense, equality of opportunity could make sense in that what we mean is no state-imposed obstacle will be placed in your path. But the problem is there's something about this mystical word equality that even if you try to keep it limited to something as modest as that, it seems to take on a life of its own. And before you know it, it is being used to reconstruct all of society.
That is inevitable, I fear, the minute you start enforcing it. And that's why I said earlier that I'm against the fact that it's being enforced. Because no matter what you call it, whether you call it equality of opportunity, equality of rights, equality of whatever you want to call it, the minute you say, right, this is going to be enforced, and you know, we're going to have an equal opportunities commission that will investigate whether everybody's opportunities are equal and take enforcement action against people who don't equalize opportunities. The minute you say that, you're going to end up with exactly the problems that we see. There is simply no way of enforcing equality that is not going to end up with the problems that we've got. So people think if you clarify that you only want to equalize opportunities, that will help, but it won't. And even with the best will of the world, how else would you enforce equal opportunities? How else would you do it? If you have an employer, for example, who says, I'm happy to offer everyone equal opportunities. And if you go into his workplace and he doesn't have a representative of every race, every sex, every gender, every religion, every, I don't know, nationality, how would you know if he's truly offering the equal opportunities he promised?
Right. And that is the difficulty with anti-discrimination law. Even if it says nothing in this legislation should be taken to mean that we want to impose a quota system. But, well, the only way that an employer can protect himself against a lawsuit is by imposing a quota system.
Exactly.
Unless you can read his mind, which you can't.
Exactly. Richard Epstein writes about that in Forbidden Grounds, his 1992 book, and he's got the evidence of employers doing exactly that for the simple reason that when you get investigated by the Equal Opportunities Commission, if you haven't got quotas, how are you going to show that you've offered everybody equal opportunities? The quotas are what help you to show that you've complied. You have to file your compliance data regularly. So you show your equal opportunities by saying, we interviewed 5 black people, 5 white people, 5 men, 5 women. That's how you prove your equal opportunities. And in order to show that you didn't discriminate against any of them, you have to show that you had equal numbers of them. That's what quotas do.
Well, I just this week spoke to Heather McDonald, who has a brand new book, and we were talking about this very thing, that I think the key proposition of the woke program is the idea that disparities in outcome between races or indeed any groups, men and women, whatever, are prima facie evidence of discrimination. That in the absence of discrimination, everybody would be equally distributed across occupations and whatever else. And the thing is, you can find these disparities all over the place. It's easy. Everybody's got these disparities. And so this is one of the valuable contributions of Thomas Sowell, because he spent much of his career explaining life is not so cartoonish. There are plenty of perfectly good reasons that you wouldn't have this kind of equality. And he gave as an example something rather obscure, but he's given a great many examples. I like this one. Some people would say, let's just look at people with PhDs. So thereby we'll correct for education. We'll look at people with PhDs. Black PhDs get paid much less than white PhDs. They do. But you know why that is? Because more than half of black PhDs are in education. And everybody knows that's a fairly unremunerative field. Correct for that, and the alleged difference goes away. And of course, Asian PhDs, which tend to be much, much more in engineering, those people earn even more than whites do. So when you actually break down the data, the wickedness dissipates.
Yes, exactly.
Everybody, a quick message from Converso. I use the Converso app for privacy because I care about privacy and because other messaging apps that tell you they're all about privacy look like the NSA next to Converso. With Converso, you've got end-to-end encryption, no storage of messages on the server, no user or metadata. And it's not just you and me. Huge percentages of Americans are saying they're concerned with their lack of privacy and data security. They're fed up with being tracked online. They distrust big tech. They think they influence politics, you think? And they think their phone's listening in on them. They believe their texts and calls are not secure. Converso solves it all. Full of great features like sensors off, completely deactivates your phone's camera and microphone for ultimate privacy. Self-destructing messages are automatically deleted from the recipient's device after a specified time. You can prevent screenshots from being taken. It's a fantastic app. As I say, I'm already using it, and I'm going to start using it with one of my super elite private groups. So be like Woods and go over to conversoapp.com and grab it. That's conversoapp.com. So let me ask you this question. We have somebody in the U.S., I guess he died in the early 2000s, named Sam Francis, and his view was that advocates of egalitarianism don't actually believe what they're saying. It is a program that they put forward to gain power for themselves because they know that a program like this, whose end goal can never possibly be reached, means a permanent bureaucracy of civil rights lawyers and litigation and regulation and a whole battery of labor inspectors and whatever. And it just keeps them going forever. It expands state power into one area after another of life. And this is how they like it. And so whether or not egalitarianism is true is very much beside the point. It's an avenue to power for them. Are you that cynical?
I think that is for sure true of many egalitarians. But I think that egalitarians, and maybe it goes back to your first question where you said, well, what is an egalitarian? Who are egalitarians? I think they have all kinds of different motivations. So there are the ones that you just described, who are in it for the power. And this is the perfect platform because the goal will never be achieved. And there are also very many vested interests. I think the whole equality industry, including the lawyers, I mean, the law has become so complex that you're always going to need lawyers to go and fight your equality claims or your equality defenses. And then there are people who are in it for the ideology. They're Marxists or communists, and this fits their ideology. They want to equalize not just opportunities, but money and power and all the other things that communists say they want to equalize. But then there are a lot of people also who just haven't given it that much thought. I think a lot of people follow along because it sounds great when you say everyone will be equal, and they say, oh, fantastic, that's great. The right side of history kind of people who want to go along with anything that sounds great. Yeah, so there are all kinds of different motivations. And then there are also the people who can see the problem with it. They don't know what to do, so they just go along. So there are many different motivations, I think.
Well, in a way, the question arises, what is the alternative? If you're saying that society should not be organized around equality as its central principle, then I think some people would think that the result would be a dystopia in which there are some super powerful people and then everybody else, which, parentheses, is in fact how society looks after 50 years of pursuing egalitarianism, by the way.
Exactly. And society without enforced equality is not a dystopia. It's what we had. So in the book that I've talked about a lot, Richard Epstein's Forbidden Grounds, he talks about the different civil rights acts and says that the society that was created by the Civil Rights Act is exactly right, where you say everyone has the right to enter into contracts and to buy and sell property, to own property. That sort of equality, where you're saying equal participation in the market, that's good equality, or equal ability to enforce contracts, for example. If you say people aren't allowed to enforce contracts based on their race or whatever, that would be dystopian. But those, so the ability to exercise your basic rights equally is what we want. What we don't want is what we see now, where you have protected grounds based on race, based on sex, and all the other grounds. We have 9 grounds in the UK, probably more than most people. But this is where civil rights goes wrong, where it starts descending into identity politics.
Well, and once you get down that path, it seems pretty difficult to overturn it. Nobody's ever going to overturn anti-discrimination law. I mean, even conservatives defend that in the United States. And the vested interests are overwhelming, and the screaming and the shouting would be deafening. And also particularly because these types of policies encourage resentment among different groups of people. They encourage finger-pointing and blaming various other groups for one's own predicament. It's very hard, once the discourse has been poisoned in that way, to pull it back, I think.
It's hard, but I don't know. I think that when people say, oh, no, we like our equality law, it's a disaster and it's causing social unrest and resentment, but we don't care, it's our equality law and we love it and we'll never get rid of it. Yes, you do see a lot of that. But I think that as things get worse, more and more people, at least in the UK, you do get people starting to say there's something very wrong with this law. So just to give an example, one of the protected grounds is religion. So you shouldn't discriminate against people on grounds of their religion. But the way it works in practice is to defend Islamic people who get angry when they feel that their religion has been disrespected. So certainly in some of those cases, we've seen people saying this operates, it looks very nice on paper, but it operates as a de facto blasphemy law, and we need to get rid of this. So that's just to give one example. And another example is what we see now with non-discrimination on grounds of gender. And I think that's made many people think there's something wrong with this law, we need to get rid of it. So I think as things get worse, more and more people start to concede that there's something not right to this law. And I think even when things are very hard to scale back, it's not impossible. I mean, we saw that with the UK leaving the EU, with Brexit. I remember when there was a time when I used to teach constitutional law and people said, it's one-way traffic, we will never leave the EU. it's impossible, it will never happen, when it happened. So I do think sometimes people get to a point where they say enough is enough.
Well, I hadn't thought of that point. Fair enough, fair enough. But when you talked about the gender thing, I think that goes to show again how this is a concept that seems to operate according to its own internal dynamic. You started off in a very tame way. You say, we want equality in this limited sense that nobody will be discriminated against and they'll all get an equal shot. And so the way that worked out with the civil rights movement was, for example, in education, we will get rid of segregation by saying the students can go to the closest school to their home if they want to. But then when that didn't generate the outcomes that they wanted, then it was, we're going to take your kid, put him on a bus for an hour and a half each way, and send him to some place he's never been before, and destroy the whole internal culture of every school, because we've now introduced confusion and resentment. And I mean, can you imagine, even if the racial element weren't present, you take a bunch of kids from one place and just plop them where they're totally not wanted by the other kids in another place, then you add the racial match and set that match, what outcome did you expect other than race relations getting much worse, education obviously not even remotely the priority in any of this? That was just in the matter of, that was in less than, what do we have, Brown versus Board in 1954, and by the late 60s, they're doing this.
Yes, it didn't take long for it all to begin unraveling.
But now to today, I guess my point is, now today we've seen the concept of equality going down roads that people in the late 1960s didn't anticipate it would go down. So what would be a good example of that?
Gender reassignment as a protected ground. Religion started out as, I mean, historically, it was terrible that Protestants could persecute Catholics, etc., Jews evicting them from the country and all this kind of thing. So now people think, oh, yeah, that's great. We'll protect religion and that won't happen anymore. But now religion means, like at least the way it works in the UK, it means any philosophical belief or none. So it's literally anything that anybody says, like, I'm a vegetarian. That's my philosophical belief. And everybody has to accommodate that. It's turned into anything that people say is their belief. I don't think that could have been anticipated at the time. We wouldn't anticipate that we won't know what a woman is when we said we'll protect people based on their sex. I mean, there's so many ways in which it's changed.
The thing of not being able to define what a woman is, I'm sure you know about the film, What is a Woman, that's hosted by Matt Walsh. And Matt Walsh says some dumb things from time to time, but other times he's obviously right. You don't have to like him overall to admit that he's obviously right about this stuff. And yet we've gotten to a point where simply asking somebody to explain what a woman is viewed as a boomer style troll. But how is that not a legitimate question? If you can't even answer that, or you think that being a woman is like a state of mind or something, then I think people need to know that, because that's not correct. And nobody thought it was correct, including most of the people advocating this view today. Even 5 years ago, nobody thought that.
Yes. And now, at least in the UK, where we have protection based on your gender reassignment, it's actually illegal to ask someone if they're a woman. You can't ask, like, if you see somebody approaching, let's say, the women's bathrooms, quite self-evidently not looking remotely like a woman. You can't say to them, hey, are you a woman? Because that's discrimination. It's unlawful. Or if they're marching into the girls' bathrooms or into the women's changing rooms or anywhere, you can't even ask them because the law stepped in and said that's discrimination if you do that.
Yeah.
So yes, it's not just that the ideas are crazy. It's also the fact, as I said earlier, that they're backed by the force of law. It's not just saying, well, this is bad manners. You know, what you're asking these questions, you're such a boomer. It's not just that. It's that it's unlawful. I think that's the idea of the Equality Act that they're proposing in the US, that's to extend civil rights to transgender people.
The thing is, once you've gone down the road of anti-discrimination law, it's actually very difficult to exclude future groups from it. Because if it's a good thing and this group is suffering from discrimination, then what's the problem?
Yes. In fact, why would you? this is the point that I've been making. So in the UK, we have 9 groups of protected people. So it's race, sex, religion, this and that and the other, including changing your gender. Well, why would you accept that certain groups need protection and not others? The minute you say people need to be protected, especially based on their personal identity, there's no logical stopping point. So it's not just transgender who are already in the law, and they're proposing to put that in the law in the US as well. But then you get these people who say, I identify as a different age, you know, like those people who say they identify as a baby, even though they're grown up. People saying that you're protecting people based on their sexual orientation. Well, my sexual orientation is I'm attracted to children, so I want to be protected. There's literally no stopping point. That's part of the problem.
That is the problem. And I think it's a problem with progressivism in general, which of course is deeply wedded to egalitarianism. But you can't imagine a progressive saying, okay, we're all done. This is the society we want.
Yes.
Everything's
yes.
done. Now you can relax and not be constantly reacting to our wild new proposals. There won't be any more coming. You know, that's not possible.
No, it's not possible. There are all kinds of proposals. And I think we can even include the environmentalists in this as well. So it's like, okay, we've conquered the human world and now we need to conquer the natural world. There's no stopping point.
Right.
We'll conquer the animal kingdom. We'll go and make wild animals behave better. There's no stopping point to it.
So as you say, you could get to a point where it's so obviously absurd or oppressive to other people that eventually people say, we don't want this anymore. The tricky thing is that you really are up against a massive existing establishment. And so what I think is in the short run more likely to happen is they will pick and choose and say, we're going to keep the anti-discrimination establishment the way we have it, and we're not going to add this group or that group to it, and try to maintain that kind of equilibrium. But I think that's an unstable equilibrium.
And they won't succeed. Do you think they'll succeed in keeping out the transgender lobby? They will not. They won't even try. Look at them. They're running scared. No, they have no chance of saying we're done with the protected groups. No more. See, here's the problem. The arguments are always the same. So first people say, oh, you keep women oppressed and it's terrible. You chain them to the kitchen sink. Let's protect them. And then it becomes, oh, you keep black people oppressed and they're all in chains. Let's protect them. And then it becomes sexuality. And they say, oh, this is exactly like what we used to do to women and black people. And then it becomes transgender. And they say, this is exactly what we used to do to. So that's why you would never succeed in drawing a line under it, because new groups will always say, but this is exactly like what you used to do to. Isn't that what the animal rights people say, for example, when they try to say you shouldn't eat meat? And people say, no, we always eat meat. And they try to say, well, isn't that exactly like in the days when there was slavery and, you know, we treated some human beings as if they weren't equal. Now we're doing exactly the same thing to animals. So that's the thing. You can never get to a point where you say enough is enough and draw a line under it. That's the problem.
Hey, folks, quick message from our sponsor, Blinkist, which is offering my audience an unprecedented 45% off. Wouldn't you like to be one of those people who seems to know something about, well, pretty much everything? And wouldn't you like not to be the guy who has about 2 sentences worth of knowledge about everything? So please don't challenge anything I say, because all I know is the 2 sentences. Blinkist can fix that problem for you in no time, because it has thousands and thousands of nonfiction titles that it has summarized for you in 15-minute chunks that you can read or listen to. So imagine how many books you can be absorbing on your commute and how quickly you can transform into that person you would love to be. I have been enjoying the many titles in their 14-day personal growth challenge, because I do believe in personal growth, but I don't believe in personal growth books, because 95% of them are fluff. But I want that 5%. That's what Blinkist gives me. Plus, their great new feature, Blinkist Connect, more or less gives you 2 subscriptions to Blinkist for the price of 1, because you can share titles that you find interesting with your friend. Right now, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/woods to start your 7-day free trial and get 45% off a Blinkist premium membership. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/woods to get 45% off and a 7-day free trial. Blinkist.com/woods. This offer is good through April 30th, 2023 only. And now for a limited time, you can even use Blinkist Connect to share your premium account. You'll get 2 premium subscriptions for the price of 1. I was reading an excerpt. I don't know if it was a transcript of a video or from his Substack or something, but from Glenn Greenwald. Now, Glenn Greenwald has a lot of enemies on the left these days because he really does hold both sides up to the same standards, which is not allowed. You know, all the egalitarians, quote unquote, who believe in equality do not believe that all people should be held to the same standards, oddly enough. But anyway, so he said this the other day. He was talking about Wellesley College, which is a left liberal college in Massachusetts, saying that it will admit, I guess, trans men or something. I forget. So here's what he said. If you believe that trans men are men, that somebody who's born female, who has a biologically female body, but who one day wakes up and says, I identify as a man, and therefore is now considered a trans man without undergoing any surgeries, altering their body in any way, even taking hormones, just that self-declaration is enough. If a trans man can now enter Wellesley according to the logic of gender ideology, Wellesley, an all-women college, now admits not only women but also men. But if Wellesley now admits men, why limit it only to trans men? Why not cis men, meaning people born as men? And he says, there's supposed to be a prohibition on viewing these two categories as different. Trans men here, that's not a permissible distinction. Trans men are men. You are forced to adhere to that and forced to affirm that. If you don't affirm that trans women are women and trans men are men, that is inherently transphobic of you. I don't even know what it is I'm expected to think about this.
Well, that's exactly correct. You can't draw a distinction between different types of women or different types of men. So that's exactly the point. If a man says, I'm a woman, like he's not trying to say he's transgender or anything, but he just shows up and says, I'm a woman. Well, you have no reason not to admit him. You can't say, you know, you aren't a woman. I'm looking at you and you can't do that. You can't draw a distinction between different types of women or different types of men.
It's very interesting how these propositions, which are highly controversial, to be generous about it, it's hard to know what percentage of people believe in gender ideology, but among the young people, it seems like it's pretty high. And why wouldn't it be? Because they get exposed to it all the time, and most people don't have the capacity for independent thought. I'm just being blunt about that. I am totally not an egalitarian when it comes to that. I've seen how many people get dragged along by every single last social trend, no matter what it is. But it was certainly led by a small number, the imposition of gender ideology. This was not a mass movement of 100 million people demanding that we read texts in gender ideology and alter our society accordingly. It was a small group that somehow took this concept of equality and, again, used it as a crowbar to pry its way into one institution in America after another. And I don't know how to end this conversation on a note of hope here, because as I talk about it, it just seems so grim and frustrating.
It is grim and frustrating, but as I see it, that in itself is where the seeds of hope lie. Because as long as these things aren't that grim and aren't that frustrating, people just go along with it. They say, oh, well, you know, it's ridiculous, but they tolerate it. They say, well, it doesn't hurt. Just call people whatever pronouns they want. I think the worse it gets, the more likely that people say we've had enough of this. I see the trend as a cause for hope.
Well, I would like to have a conversation where we actually look at, preferably your most recent book, Redressing Historical Injustice, and we go into the specifics of what your arguments are there. I'm curious to know, by the way, given that you wrote that book with David Gordon, who is one of, as you know, one of the smartest people in the whole world. I mean, it's almost absurd how much knowledge he has across disciplines. How did you get to know him to the point where he would actually want to work on a project with you? He's never asked me to work on a project.
Well, so what happened when I wrote the previous book, the one on equality law, and I was really trying to get caught up on the reading because, as I say, this wasn't my field at all. And I was trying to follow Richard Epstein and I was trying to follow Hayek. And it was at that point, I was writing about classical liberalism and libertarianism without a very clear understanding of the difference between the different types of classical liberals or what the difference is between classical liberalism and libertarianism. So when I was working on that book and I asked him if he would write a foreword to the book, and I sent him what I was working on, and he basically said, "You've got it all mixed up." There were so many different strands, and I hadn't quite realized what the differences were between them, simply because I didn't have the background of reading. It wasn't my field. So that's how we started working together. He said, "Read this and read this, read the other." He was my shortcut into the literature. Otherwise, it would have taken me the next 50 to 100 years to try and work out what the relevant literature was and how it all fits in. So that's how our collaboration began. And the whole book was completely transformed with his input, just showing what the different debates were. Because as you know, he's written about all this in his reviews over the years. So I drew a lot upon that. So if you look at my book, the Equality Law book, you'll see that it's structured around two questions that David asks in his previous reviews about: is inequality unfair? And does justice require that we should try to make everybody equal? So I structured the book around those two questions, which he had written about in some of his previous work. So in that first book, because as I say, it was about equality law, and the questions about justice were implicit, but not quite. I didn't have time and space in that book to work on them. So that's how that project spilled over into a new book that we wrote, the one that you're just talking about, Redressing Historical Injustice. So that's how David and I started collaborating. So just to summarize, simply it was his willingness to help me out. He's so, so generous.
And his brain is a giant bibliography.
Yes.
It's amazing. And he's read them all too. So it's not just a listing. He's actually read them all. I don't know if you know this, but in Rothbard's papers, he has a letter to, I don't know who the recipient is, but he wrote the letter the day he met David Gordon for the first time. And in the letter, he writes, "Today I met a universal genius." So that's an interesting tidbit. Imagine having Rothbard say that about you.
Yeah, that's incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, you know, he's a tough critic, that Murray Rothbard.
Yeah. And you know what I'm most appreciative of from David, from what you're saying? I can't imagine how long it would take anybody to dig up all these resources if they didn't know where to look. I think it would take a lifetime. He knows where all the arguments are. He knows who published them.
Yeah.
He knows the title, knows the dates, and sometimes he even knows the page number.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I'll never forget. He was on a panel with Hans Hoppe. And they were talking about something involving Kant. And Hans was groping toward exactly where this particular argument could be found in Kant. And David cited it with incredible precision. And then deadpan, Hans said, "Yes, that is the passage I was thinking of." Just left it there. We're all in the presence of this really, really extraordinary mind. And I'm so glad that you guys were able to collaborate. What I've never, as I said, I've never collaborated with him on a project, but for a couple of my early books, I had David read the manuscript because I knew he would find mistakes, and I'd rather have him find mistakes beforehand than while he's reading the book to review. So I would have him do it. And he was always so generous. He is, as you say, he is so, so eager to help and share his knowledge. So I'm glad he was able to do it.
Yes, because when I asked him for help, you know, I was just a stranger from the internet. He had no idea who I was, and he helped me out. So there you go.
Yeah. Yeah. He's a good man. So on the show notes page, I'm actually going to link to both of your books, even though we sort of discussed them in a very roundabout way. But in the future, we should talk about one of them more directly. But the show notes page will be tomwoods.com/2320 for today's episode. And that's where I'll have those links. And what the heck, I'll link to your faculty page at the University of Exeter Law School. Why not? And people can drop you a line and say hello. So thanks so much for talking to me about this subject today. And we'll dig into it a little bit deeper next time when I manage to get my hands on one of your books.
Thanks so much, Tom. Thanks for having me on. It's been great to chat.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at Podsworth.com.